you know, that kids smoking in the cars and other stuff.
Hey, colleagues and audience, welcome to this Friday, March 15, 2013, meeting of the House Committee on Higher Education and Workforce Development. Today is Friday, so it's Governance Day here for us, and we are going to be focusing today on the subjects of revenue bonds, tuition setting, and board composition. And I'd like to start off by inviting up Laura Lockwood McCall from the Treasurer's Office. And Michael, are you going to come up as well? Or? No. Okay. All right. Colleagues, henceforth, when you think bonds, you think Laura Lockwood McCall.
Got it.
She knows everything there is to be known.
I sincerely felt that. For the chair, good morning. My name is Laura Lockwood McCall. I'm the director of the Debt Management Division in the Oregon State Treasury. I don't have any formal remarks, but if it would be all right with the chair, I could sort of talk about the backdrop. We've been looking at a lot of different higher ed university governance bills. You may remember I testified, I think, a little over a year ago before a committee that you chaired.
It was less than a year.
Less than a year. Currently, I don't have exact numbers in front of me, but we have several hundred million dollars in higher ed 11G bonds, which are the general obligation bonds where there's a match. The state pays a general fund debt, and universities provide a 50% match. We have over $1 billion in 11F1 bonds, and these are the general obligation bonds that are fully self-supported.
Excuse me. I'd like those numbers.
I apologize. I didn't know that I was going to make formal, but I will send you exact numbers. We have a debt capacity report that we provide each year, and that's been given to each member.
Oh, I do.
And I can get you the exact numbers as of today. But in just broad terms, the 11F bonds is the thing that we're most concerned about in the Treasurer's Office as we move to a new model for university governance. As I was saying, there's roughly $1.1 billion in 11F1 bonds, which are the self-supporting general obligation bonds. Now, the reason they're self-supporting is the universities have pledged collectively through the OUS system various revenue streams for their auxiliaries. That includes dorm fees, parking garage fees, sometimes tuition, in various revenue streams. And we've always been very comfortable that it's a good, safe credit that the general fund would never be tapped because these collective revenue streams have fund balance on top of just the revenue streams themselves. As we move to a new model where universities may be authorized to sell revenue bonds, whether it was as a system, the OUS system as a whole, or individual campuses, our concern is that those revenue streams have already been pledged, first and foremost, to this $1.1 billion in general obligation bonds of the state. And so we want to make sure as we come up with our new paradigm, if you will, of how things are going to work, that those revenue streams are still always first pledged to pay off the general obligation bonds of the state. So general fund is never touched. Our credit rating as a state's never endangered. And we think that's just an important consideration. We can make sure that debt service is paid every year first before revenue bonds. But the crux of the matter is, would we allow, once these new revenue bond programs are established and the subordinate liens are pledged, should we allow universities to come back in and ask for more general obligation bonds that are of the 11F variety? The 11G variety seems to me to be a horse of a different color because it's a 50% match, and the state pays it through its general fund, and you, as a legislature, can make a decision each time you decide on bonding whether or not that's a worthy project. But the 11F, because it's tied to revenue streams, once these indentures are created for revenue bonds, it needs to be very clear as to whose priority is first. And so to that extent, we have asked the universities, as different representatives from different schools have talked to us, that if you want to continue to have access to 11F, we think it's important that Treasury and through our lawyers at Department of Justice, we're looking through your indentures, we're looking through your cash flows, and we're just making sure at all times that there's sufficient revenues to cover all of those 11F1 bonds. whether it's before or after they break away. Some schools are happy with that situation that we've talked to. They say, no problem. We want to actually work closely with Treasury to continue to provide some assistance to them, even in the pricing of their revenue bonds, if they chose to do that, because we have pricing power since we sell lots of bonds, and we've been in the market, you know, 20 times a year, and hopefully between myself and my deputy director, we have collectively about 50 years of experience dealing with Wall Street. Other schools have indicated that they would like to chart their own course, and in conversations on Senate bill, one of the versions of the bills, as we've been talking it through, the Dash 1 amendments in Senate Bill 270 that I've seen copies of that haven't been introduced yet would allow an option, and a university that had an independent board could either opt to continue to have access through, of course, your approval to all these different bonding things, including the 11F bonds, or they could say, we're opting out, we want to do revenue bonds, we never want to come back ever again to ask for GO bonding through the 11F process. And one could quibble whether they should have access to lottery bonds, state 11Q bonds, which is just another GO bond program, which there isn't a match, or COPs or other things. But that's about the state of the art in terms of the conversation. I would also add, I'm not directly responsible for cash management, but there's similar issues that folks in my agency have with regard to banking services, cash management services, in terms of having an opt-in or an opt-out. If folks want to opt in, then they have to follow our rules, and they get the benefits of the group purchasing power, but they also have the responsibility to follow the rules. If they opt out, we think that we still need authority to control bond proceeds issued by the state in our treasury, as well as debt service payments need to be kept in our treasury, not in some other bank account, just to assure that debt service payments are made on time.
Okay. Thank you, Laura. Questions?
Yeah.
Rep. Greenlee?
No.
Oh, it's a bit overwhelming.
Yeah, that's a lot.
Yeah. Representative, did you have?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll go back and look at the book,
and I agree
with my colleague, Mr. Representative Greenlee. You threw a lot at us quickly.
Sorry.
I did ask Mr. Keaton last time he appeared before this committee about are the universities borrowing money for PERS obligations, and he indicated that's true. I was also able to add to the Taxpayers Transparency website a link to the PERS board information on unfunded liability. I did not include universities on that. Should I do that, or we have a problem? You think the Treasurer's office is looking after our money there?
You asked a lot of questions through the chair.
Through the fact.
Well, I will say,
acknowledge that on the grounds of relevance to the topic.
The state as a whole, with the universities as a subset of that whole, borrowed money in 2003 for pension obligation unfunded liability. So the answer is yes, that occurred. It occurred in 2003, and we borrowed $2 billion plus on behalf of the entire state. Subsequently, there has been no borrowing by the university to fund any additional unfunded liabilities through PERS. So the answer is yes, but you got to understand the context.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
What's our annual debt on that then?
I'm going to give you a rough number,
yes,
because
ma'am.
I can't give you an exact number. Yeah. I don't do that much debt in my head, but at roughly $2 billion, we borrowed at 5.75%, so I'm going to guesstimate that it's about 1/12 of $2 billion. So I'm going to say, sorry, I'm doing the math in my head.
Right.
It's in probably the $150 million to $175 million per year, and I can get you that exact mm-hmm. number.
Thank you.
So just to follow up on that, so the state saved a lot of money by doing that, right?
Yes.
I mean, otherwise it would have had to pay 8%. Right?
Through the chair, at the time that the decision was made to borrow, the all-in cost of funds was 5.75%. If we had continued to fund unfunded liability to PERS, we would have paid an 8% rate of basically cost of funds, because that's the assumed rate.
Yeah.
The saving of money or not saving of money, unfortunately, is something you can't know till the 30, 25 years that the bonds were sold, because the ultimate goal is, did you earn more than 5.75% in PERS every year in terms of are you better off or worse off? But in the short term, the answer was yes, it reduced our cost of funds.
Mm-hmm.
in those years considerably.
Right. Yeah, I'll just follow up on that point, Laura. For my own college, Portland Community College, because it, I think, wisely invested, you know, at the time, did bonding around the same time as the state, it has saved a little more than $45 million since then. So it was a very wise investment. There are certain schools, though, I will say, that were hurt because they didn't do it. They entered the bond program just as the market crashed, and that was, you know, that was unfortunate.
It, through the chair, there was an article in the Oregonian that it did a good job, believe it or not, several weeks ago. and it looked exactly at that question. The earlier in the 2000s that you borrowed, whether your interest rate was as low or as high between 2001 and 3, a big chunk of the savings comes from, did you get in the market at the right moment? And so that's why we won't know ultimately if it's a good or bad choice.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Rep. Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for being here. And it's easy to see why you get the praise from our chair on your expertise. But I am curious if you have a preference of, in this area, of Roger Moore or Sean Connery or
Daniel Craig. I should say Darren Bond. He's the deputy treasurer, so that would be the ultimate Bond, my
there
boss.
You go.
So.
Okay, thank you. So going back to the issue at hand, if we can. There really are a couple of issues here, right, Laura? I mean, one is, the treasurer has to make sure that whatever the universities do, the treasury is protected, right? That there aren't encumbrances made that, because of decisions that the treasury has had no hand in or where there perhaps hasn't been adequate oversight.
Sure.
Yes. If the universities were to completely separate themselves, then Treasury wouldn't have such a concern in the matter because the state would be protected from the decisions made by the individual university.
And I can elaborate. I've been asked to talk very narrowly just about our credit rating and our financial situation. Clearly, we care about whether education remains affordable and accessible to Oregonian students. But, again, having to just answer that narrow question, when OHSU broke away from the state, it was prior to my time here in Oregon, but the decision was made to do that. And so they have their own separate revenue bond program, credit rating. There was some legacy GO debt, and there was arrangements made for them to continue to pay that debt service. But Treasury has not reviewed any bonding programs or anything that they've done subsequently. I will say that Department of Justice continues to play an active role in review from a legal perspective, and that's because the land underneath OHSU property is owned by the state. And so there is a continued review to make sure that in the legal documents that we haven't somehow pledged something that's owned by the state, that they need to be clear, and they have a 99-year lease. I have heard from the Department of Justice attorney that sometimes she's not quite sure about what's going on from the cash flow perspective, because she's looking again in her world at the very narrow questions of law, real estate. But we in Treasury, I can say, we sort of talked about this idea of just reviewing documents but not approving, and we think that that's inappropriate because, frankly,
inappropriate.
From our perspective, you're kind of involving us, but then you don't give us any authority if there's a problem. So we'd rather be all in or all out, because halfway is complicated, and it's unclear to us how we could affect change. And if you're looking for oversight, you have to give us the authority to say yay or nay. And that's okay for some schools, and it's not okay for other schools. In their perfect world.
Right, and let me just clarify. We talked about this in the Joint Special Committee, and I think the way the drafting happened maybe didn't exactly reflect what I think we were interested in. You know, we as a committee felt that that Treasury, we didn't want to give Treasury veto power over a project. You know, that is to say, it's a bad idea for you to build a parking lot, you know, on your campus. What the role of the Treasury would be to see, you know, have you done the process correctly? Do you have the wherewithal to, pay back those bonds without your overall rating being hurt, et cetera,
sure.
et cetera?
Well, I would think if you wanted to have review and approval, you could clarify what the topics are that we're supposed to find. You know, you could use findings, which do the cash flows meet the debt service? Does the state's credit rating stay, you know, unimpaired? You know, you could create some framework. And we've begun conversations, frankly, with Portland State on that very topic. We already do cash flow reviews under state law for all these GO bonds that are self-supporting, whether it be the SELP program, veterans mortgage loan programs. You know, we're always reviewing before we sell. You authorize all sorts of GO bonds, and we don't impede people from doing them. We just simply make them prove to us from a financial perspective in the self-supporting bond case that those cash flows are sufficient for the life of the bonds as best we can know today, so that the general fund, again, won't be affected and the state's credit rating won't be impaired. So, again, there's adequate, I think, state law you could point to in terms of the nature of the cash flow reviews and the legal reviews.
Okay, thank you. Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The bill, the language that came out of our committee and so forth, says that before issuing a revenue bond, the board shall submit the proposed bond issuance to the state treasurer for review. Does not say approval. Says review. So I think that's important to examine that. But it wouldn't have in view a completely a board that would be outside of this purview, okay? I.e., one that would want to say, we want to be totally independent, we want to pull out of that review process. So the draft, as it stands, doesn't have that in view, if I read it correctly, Mr. Chair. So that is something, obviously, we're going to have to consider if we're going to allow for that possibility or not, I think. Well, my question would be, in regards to any sort of interaction you have with OHSU, do you currently review their bond, their proposals in any kind of courtesy
through the chair?
At all?
I know not at all.
They don't ask for approval or review. Is that correct?
No, there is a review required, and when the MOU was designed, the Department of Justice reviews the legals from the real estate and making sure that they haven't pledged the state's full faith and credit. But that is the only interaction we've had at all over the last decade.
And as you recall, that was one of the sticky wickets, if you will, in our discussions in the interim on this, in that if we have a public university who now has this autonomy to do things more creatively and so forth, but yes, obviously this is still property that's owned by the state of Oregon, buildings that have been constructed by the state of Oregon, how free are they to use those assets to pursue what they believe is in their best interest as an institution? Are they ever completely free? And it sounds like there is some
judicial. There's a 99-year lease, so they can't pledge the land, but you can do a lot with everything above the land.
Correct. So those are some of the dynamics that are in play here.
That's right. But also, you know, if you look at the, you know, when OHSU became a public corporation, their bond rating fell at that time, didn't it, Laura?
To my understanding, I mean, they were part of the state, so the state's credit rating was kind of falling at the time, too. So we have subsequently improved our credit rating. Theirs was in the triple Bs, then we moved to a global scale, and so they're now, I believe, an A-. Healthcare institutions in general don't necessarily have quite as high a credit ratings as states. I mean, it depends on the institution. So I can't say that I'm quite an expert on the details. I will say that when you sell a lot of bonds and revenues don't come in necessarily at the rates that you thought, you know, it puts more pressure on your margins. But there's a lot of other reasons why healthcare institutions have pressure on their margins that are different than the reason the states do.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
most healthcare, the nonprofit healthcare institutions at least, have a more reasonable debt-to-equity ratio. OHSU doesn't exactly
This is an area that I'm way out of my depth. So, but I'd say in broad terms, yes. Each organization has sort of a different history and development over time. So that would be a challenge. I will say that the University of Oregon, if it launched on its own, just for an example, would probably be a strong AA, at least initially, because the chancellor's office across all of the universities has imposed financial discipline in terms of how much debt they could issue on this of the 11F type, which, you know, they may be at the top of the range right now for what the university chancellor office has imposed, but relatively speaking, they're all fairly well positioned if they were to launch. Maybe the smaller schools would be a little lower credit rating, but I've seen a number of studies by financial advisors and underwriters that have sort of looked at all those ratios of universities and suggested at least they would initially all start out strong.
So the special committee decided on a debt ratio of 7%, I think. That's what the
And I would, through the chair, I would have quibbled with sort of the wording on the debt ratio because we need it to be clear. It's annual debt service is a percentage of annual revenue, and I think we weren't quite as precise in that language as we weren't with review and approval. So if you were going to continue, but I will say that when you do a revenue bond program, we do them for, let's say, example, lottery bonds or ODOT, our coverage factors, the indenture is a driver, and our ratios are a bit higher than that. So, for example, with lottery bonds, it's a 4x coverage. That means up to 25%. Now, granted, that's the lottery bond. In ODOT, we have a 3x coverage and a 2x coverage. Different programs, different purposes. But that 7% would be low if you're trying to do a revenue bond. They would have a very high credit rating. So there might be something between 7 and some number that you would feel comfortable with that would allow them to get good credit ratings, but would give them a bit more leverage and flexibility.
Yeah, I think we modeled it after OUS's debt ratio.
It was a very different world. And, you know, I don't know the perfect number as, but I'm just suggesting that revenue bonds generally have a little bit more room in them and their indentures.
Okay, so the limit is perhaps not as important as just, you know, the oversight piece.
Through the chair, indirectly, it can matter to you all because obviously you're concerned about keeping tuition within affordable ranges. But I can't explain to you the context of how much should they spend on capital, how much should they spend on operations. And I can just sort of tell you as a bond wonk, we like more revenue, obviously, because that means it's a safer credit, but it may be counterpurpose to your own goals and your desires. And so there's maybe different ways to try and articulate what you're trying to accomplish by keeping a tight limit on debt.
Mm-hmm. So as a professional bond lady, you like high tuition, but as a mother, you like low tuition.
Obviously, more revenue is a safer credit. So, I'm smart enough to recognize that this is an optimization exercise, and it may not be the best credit rating. What you want to do is optimize across a variety of public policy goals.
Thank you, Rip Gilliam.
Quick clarification: we are in informational meeting mode, not we don't have a public hearing open, right?
We will in a second,
but right now,
yes.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, yes, Rep. Johnson.
Just to help the committee, and in particular Rep. Gilliam, we're actually in, this is House Bill 2149, but specifically Section 11 is the one that deals with the bonding capacity. If you want to follow along.
Yeah. Actually, technically, Rep. Gilliam is correct. We are in an information session right now. And as soon as Laura is through, we will move into the public hearing.
If you got here on time.
any other questions of Ms. Lockwood McCall? Okay.
Thank you, Mary.
Thank you very much.
Clarification.
Great.
Mr. Chair, before?
Yeah.
For us guys that weren't all in it, now, but I wanted to be sure I'm on the right path or on the right target here. We may not see the bill. Is that correct? It comes from the Senate. 2149 is our bill, but we may work the Senate Bill 270. We may never, as a policy committee, get to see this bill. Is that correct?
It's a possibility. We have several routes open to us. Yes. And a lot of that is going to depend on your pleasure, colleagues. So, yes.
I'd like to work a bill.
Yeah.
You know how legislators are. They love their bills. Okay. Yes. Thank you. Okay. So with that, I'm going to close the informational hearing.
This is the important issue. I don't know if this is the forum, but I don't know why we're wasting all our time. If what's going to happen is the Senate bill is going to go to Ways and Means and the floor, let's say Friday off. But, I mean, if there's some way to make an impact on it,
yes,
on the process, and it's certainly worth.
That was the point I'm making.
Yes, no, I suspect that we will be working our bill. The question is, will we incorporate what the Senate is doing? Will we do a completely separate process? Will we make what we're doing here part of the larger governance bill? These are some questions that, you know, we're going to have to figure out over the next couple of weeks. Okay. All right. So with that, I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2149 to allow for some public testimony on the various issues that we've put on the agenda for today, the tuition setting authority, board composition, and revenue bond. And I think a number of people have signed up. Before we start it, I passed out to you a handout that I put together last night called Board Composition. And, you know, one of the issues that we have that, you know, we wrestled with in the special joint committee but ended up leaving blank, as it were, was the question of how many members of the university community should be part of the board and in what capacity. And if you look at House Bill 4061, that's up at the top of the handout, there, one of the charges of the special committee was to define how local boards will be appointed, ensuring that students, faculty, and other university staff will be represented. And, you know, that was part of our charge, and we talked about it, but in the end, we couldn't settle on a number or in, you know, in some people's opinion, whether or not there should even be students, faculty, and staff on the boards. I've included the summary, and I just, as you can see from the type, I just cut and pasted from the handouts that the testimony that we got from U of O, from PSU, and from OSU relevant to this issue. The U of O recommended a board of 15 members, 7 appointed by the governor, 1 appointed by the State Board of Higher Ed, 6 appointed by the U of O board. Initially, they were interested in the board reappoint, you know, sort of self-replicating, as it were. U of O president as ex officio, chair elected by the board, includes faculty, student, classified employee, and foundation representatives. PSU called for a 10 to 20 person board, both public and university community members. Majority of the members should be appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. Faculty, staff, the student body, the system board, community, business, other education, alumni, and foundation interests should be present on the board. OSU, through Ed Ray, blah, 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 there's a lot here. Just students, faculty, and staff should be represented on the local board with perhaps 2-year terms. He was calling for 6-year terms for regular members, and he was looking at a 12 to 15 person board. And then the State Board, on the backside, the State Board of Higher Ed Institutional Governance Proposal in May, the boards should include as members, faculty, and students, perhaps in the same proportions as at the Oregon State Board of Higher Ed, may also include university staff, alumni, and donor foundation representatives. And then finally, I included a piece of a news item from the Washington Post. As the special committee was meeting, some of you may have picked up on, there was a real crisis at the University of Virginia where their board fired their very popular president sort of went off the reservation in some people's opinion. And that was a board that it did not include have any educators on it. And subsequent to that, so the board fired the president, and then after some stern conversations with their governor, they rescinded that decision. And subsequent to that, some changes were made that put educators onto the board in an attempt to make sure that you know, the boards really had a good sense of what was going on the ground. Okay, so just a kind of quick summary of that before we hear from people testifying. So I'd like to call up Emily Pleck. I think you're on a time constraint. Yeah. David Coburn and Evan Bryan, please.
Thank you, Chair Denbrough. Thank you, Vice Chair Harker, Vice Chair Huffman, and members of the committee. I appreciate this opportunity to speak with you today. My name is Emily Pleck. I'm a professor of communication studies at Western Oregon University. I am also, for a few short months more, the president of the Western Oregon University Federation of Teachers, and I also have the privilege of serving on our State Board of Higher Education. I'm here, though, in my capacity as a faculty member today to tell you not only how crucial student representation and staff representation is to the daily work that I do as a faculty member and to our shared governance at the university, but also the role that these positions must play in institutional governing boards if they are to come to pass in our university system. I believe that our university is much stronger for the shared governance that our student elected student bodies and elected faculty and staff bodies bring to that table and bring to those conversations. And while I have many concerns about institutional governing boards at institutions, I believe that should they come to pass, we must have seats allocated for students, for classified and unclassified staff, and for faculty. Further, I wish for those to be appointed seats rather than appointments made by the board itself. And I think while many boards and many presidents will say at the outset that they would seek the input of those stakeholders no matter what the process looks like, we all know that when decisions are contentious and staff and faculty and students are going against the grain, their voices can easily be ignored if they're not at the table and they're not empowered to help make those decisions. So I'm just simply imploring you today that if you write this legislation, if Portland State, the University of Oregon, and Oregon State University are to see institutional governing boards as a reality in their future, that those governing boards include strong student representation, representation from faculty, and representation from staff. I may not be a university president and may not have the best vantage point for determining if an institutional board is the best decision for a university, but I know who the stakeholders are and who the carriers of those university missions are, and they need to be at that table. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative.
May I ask a question?
Yes, please.
Is there some general principle behind your statement that deals with university boards as being different than other, say, nonprofit boards?
Yes, and I think it has to do with the functions that would reside with those boards. With nonprofit organizations, I think there are a different set of stakeholders, which may or may not include employees of that organization or the members who are served by that organization. With a governing board for an institution, we have responsibilities dealing with research, instruction, achievement compacts, intellectual property, diversity planning, learning outcomes. All of that requires faculty input. When it comes to setting tuition, university housing, student services, academic support, we need the students' input on that. Property maintenance, building repair, financial aid, campus public safety, without the staff's input and advice on those matters, we're really leaving it to people who don't understand the day-to-day operations necessarily to make decisions about how those things function at our universities. I think with managing a nonprofit, many of those responsibilities are narrowed. They're more focused on the operations of that nonprofit, and they're not as diversified across the institution.
Well, my understanding of organization theory would be that the board doesn't deal with the operations of the institution, that the board generally deals with broad policy issues and the hiring and firing of executive staff. I mean, you see university boards as dealing more involved on the operations side than the policy side?
I agree with you on the policy setting side, but I think that policy emerges out of those daily operations, and without a clear understanding of the operational aspect of the organization, often the policy is disjointed from the reality on the ground.
Thank you. And let me follow up on that, Emily. And, you know, looking at your role on the State Board of Higher Ed, where, as I understand, you're a voting member of that board, I think essentially what we're looking at with these university boards is taking what the State Board of Higher Ed is doing and, you know, devolving the policy setting and those authorities, you know, onto the institutional board. Thinking of the work that you do, okay, let me back up and say I was really struck when one of our special committee members was Matt Donegan, who's the president of the State Board of Higher Ed, a real business kind of guy. And he, at one point he told us that he was really surprised, actually, when he became the president and saw that there were students and faculty on the board. That seemed unusual to him, you know, given his background. And he was a little concerned that what we were going to get was, faculty and students just, focused on their own issues, their own needs, and, becoming ultimately perhaps a disruptive force in the boards. And he said he was very pleasantly surprised that that did not happen, that, in fact, the faculty and the students were really looking at, the largest sense of the good as far as the university missions. Emily, has that been your experience?
Absolutely, and I think that that's the role of any board member, and that would be whether it's an institutional board or a statewide governing board or the Higher Education Coordinating Commission. I do think that the difficulty comes, and it's interesting that you mentioned Matt's role as the board chair, and I have the utmost respect for my fellow board members. I think they're deeply committed to higher education. What they may lack is that everyday understanding of what happens at a university from Monday to Friday, and it's that perspective that the students and the faculty representatives are able to bring, as well as some of the things that are unique to just working in a higher education environment. Those are things that are lacking, and I've noticed that in my time on the board, the perspective and the input of our staff at our Oregon University system is lacking from those board conversations. I try to insert that voice to the extent that I'm able to do so, but I think that it's crucial if we're to find another form of governance that that perspective be brought forward, because I do see it as a shortcoming of our current structure in the State Board of Higher Ed.
Thank you. Yes, Rep. Gorsuch.
And do you find, certainly at my college, what I find is that there is a spillover between policy setting and day-to-day operations. Would you agree that they're not mutually exclusive?
Absolutely. We're the folks who have to live with those policies, and so it's important that we not only have the buy-in into them, but understand how they become operationalized.
But you're not testifying that one's better than the other. What you're saying is that cooperation between the two is what's important.
And I think we have universities and university presidents right now that are really focused on building that kind of cooperative enterprise, but I can't guarantee that those folks will always be in those offices, and that's why we need structures that enable and strengthen that participation and make sure that it's always there.
And in terms of my experiences with student government at Mount Hood, what I've seen is that the students do have the best interests. They're not self-centered. They have the best interests of the whole institution. At least the people that I've seen in student government.
We wouldn't be passing tuition increases.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, thanks, Rep. Gorsuch. Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, I'd be interested in your perspective. My experience as a faculty member and also my experience as a board member with nonprofits. In this case, are not the faculty paid employees of the institution, therefore a conflict of interest in terms of policy making, particularly with regard to fiduciary kinds of issues?
I think you raise an important point when it comes to the negotiation of salary and benefits, and it would certainly be inappropriate for someone in my capacity who serves on a collective bargaining team to also at the same time represent the board in that capacity. And I think that there might be a set of decisions from which any board member might be expected to recuse themselves because of their own personal stake in it. I would hope that I would be able to provide input in that capacity without necessarily impacting a vote in a manner that is contrary to the interests of the institution, because as a faculty member, I have one set of interests. As a board member, I have another set of responsibilities that I have to honor.
Mm-hmm. So we would have to, if we were crafting legislation that included staff members on the board or students on the board, to, you know, clearly set the parameters for those recusals and the conflicts of interest. That's right. Rep. Huffman, I think, was next. No, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you.
And then Rep. Greenlund.
Emily, with that thought in mind, perhaps it would be a simpler solution for both, let's say, staff and student participation to put them in an advisory capacity rather than a governing capacity on a board like this, i.e. ex officio members, to ensure that, therefore, there wouldn't be any conflicts and so forth. Still there to be able to provide input, to be able to guide and direct the workings and the processes and so forth, observe what's going on, be able to weigh in as needed and as wanted and so forth, but then there wouldn't be any sort of entangling sort of situation where you could wonder whether it was inappropriate or not to be a part of a discussion. What do you think about that?
At their best, such advisory capacities do precisely what you've outlined. At their worst, they become advice when we like what the advice sounds like and disregarded when we don't. And I think that that's the really crucial role that having voting membership on a board plays. It's balanced with a number of perspectives. No single entity can prevail in a decision-making environment where you have board members across a variety of interests. But to ask key stakeholders to simply provide advice but have no authority in decision-making, I think is disregarding two of the most important groups that make our universities function, the students that come there in the first place and the people who make sure that they have classes to go to and an enrollment process and the support services and places to live and eat and subsist while they're there. To cut those voices, potentially cut those voices out or at least diminish their capacity to make those, have a voice in those decisions, I think is both potentially disrespectful and harmful to the overall decision-making process.
Thanks, Emily. Rep.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to comment. We're thinking about this decision in the context of universities in this state, where the faculty and student government have a very weak, a relatively weak role in the governance of the institution. Other models have the Faculty Senate, for example, with some very strong powers on the academic side of government, and the student government having some very strong functions and issues around tuition and student activities and a variety of things. I really prefer a model that has much stronger participation. I'm not sure if that's going to be in the scope of what we're thinking of, but it seems to me if you're going to have weak formal participation of the faculty and the students, then this is one way to deal with that. But I think there are other models that might actually provide better input for faculty and for students on issues that really are important to them and have then a formal channel to express their opinion on these issues to the board. So, I mean, if we're going to take sort of the way we do it around here as a given, then I think it is important to have these representation on the board. But I'd be much happier with a stronger structure that had more formal, more power, more real power for the faculty and the student government and in the governance of the university.
Okay, thank you, Rick Greenlick. Okay, why don't we move on then and hear from students. David?
Yeah. Mr. Mullen, I'm providing my written testimony to your committee assistant.
So, David, identify yourself for the record, please.
All right. For the record, my name is Dave Coburn. I'm the legislative director at the Associated Students of Portland State University. I'm a member of the Oregon Student Association Board of Directors.
And, David, you don't need to be right up close. Yeah. Oh, okay. Actually, if you sit back, it's even better.
So, thank you, Dembro, and members of the Higher Education and Workforce Development Committee. The goal of my testimony is to examine critically whether HB 2149 addresses the concerns brought forward by students and our institutional board principles. I contend that the bill does not address these concerns. Before we begin, I will briefly state the principles, then examine specifically Section 1 of the bill, then discuss consistency, the maintenance of a statewide vision, and finally access and affordability. OSA's institutional board principles briefly stated are, 1, maintaining voices of important stakeholders in decision-making, 2, limiting unnecessary competition and duplication, 3, maintaining a system with a statewide vision and equal treatment of regional universities, 4, maintaining shared services and the benefits of economy of scale, 5, maintaining statewide bargaining rights, 6, a clear tuition setting process. Having laid out the metric of evaluation, we will now proceed to section 1. Initially, HB 2149 attempts to address concerns brought forward. Section 1 posits that institutional boards do not negatively impact regional universities when regional universities have specifically stated that removing Portland State University and University of Oregon would be detrimental to those universities. Further, Section 1E states that the constitution and composition of the board is to be similar to that of the State Board of Higher Education. Notably, the institutional boards proposed do not include students, faculty, or staff. The current composition of the State Board of Higher Education has a key feature of 2 students and 2 faculty representatives. Without these key stakeholders, the comparison of institutional boards is not only dissimilar to the State Board of Higher Ed, but missing key stakeholders that have on-the-ground experience that is important to consider in making decisions which affect in very tangible ways not only the quality of education, but the daily experiences of the students, faculty, and staff that live under these policies. It is further important that student, faculty, and staff voices be chosen by their constituencies to maintain fair and representative voices at the decision-making table. On matters of consistency, it is not clear why the University of Oregon and Portland State University are singled out. It is apparent to me, at least, that significant portions of the Portland State community are not in support of institutional boards, which is listed as a key requirement for universities seeking institutional boards. Why is Portland State University exempt from this requirement? The institutional boards also have significant power to delegate their authority to university presidents. In fact, there is almost no limitation to this delegation, which can substantially eliminate both the usefulness of the board and accountability of the university president. It was not long ago that a decision was made that a university president had conduct that did not fit the interests of the state of Oregon. In regards to access and affordability, this bill does not represent any reinvestment in post-secondary education, nor does it represent revenue power that does not ultimately rely on tuition as the primary source for budget shortfalls. In addition, Portland State University and University of Oregon have seen substantial cost increases that Oregon State University has not since building institutional board readiness. The difference of over 70% in cost increases raises concerns about access and affordability in this model. Finally, the tuition setting process for amounts exceeding 5% is still not clear. Does the responsibility lie with the HEC, the OEIB, or the state legislature? This bill does little to address the standing concerns of students originally posted in our institutional board principles released in 2012. Thank you for your time and work. While today's testimony was highly critical, I appreciate the time and effort that committee members put into higher education advocacy and maintaining an awareness of our shared vision of a more affordable and accessible post-secondary education system that allows all students a chance at success.
Thank you very much, Dave. And I have a couple of questions for you, but why don't we hear from Evan first?
Thank you, Chair Dembrough, members of the committee. My name is Evan Bryan. I'm a student at Eastern Oregon University. I'm active in the student government as Vice President for Political Affairs, and I serve on the board of the Oregon Student Association. Some concerns I have about the creation of institutional governing boards at Oregon's public universities is the fact that it is more university government, more layers that students and faculty need to go through to have their voices heard. I'm also concerned that it might take away from the collaborative governing efforts of OUS. I believe it's important for Oregon's universities to have kind of a collaboration and work together in setting policy, and I believe it might, with institutional boards, take away the uniformity of that governing process. Also, there's a lack of student and faculty representation on these boards. A bill very similar to this on the other side of the building in the Senate right now, there's an amendment that would say one student serve on the institutional board. I'd say at least 2 or 3 need to serve on the board. Now, whether they vote or not, that can be debated and talked about, but I think it's very important to have student representation on these boards because ultimately the policy that happens on these boards is going to affect students. Also, there's no guarantee protection of regional universities in any of this legislation. I know perhaps more amendments could be considered to this legislation to really outline the specifics about how this will affect Southern, Eastern, and Western. I know I've spoken to my colleagues, I should say, from student government at the other regional schools, and we share the same concerns about that. Can it be outlined in this legislation how exactly institutional boards will affect the regional schools? Also, the legislation does not mention shared services such as payroll and legal services. I know each university has a legal counsel from OUS, and how would institutional governing boards affect the future of services like that? And that is all I have. I'll gladly take any questions.
Thank you, Evan. Colleagues? Yes, Rep. Rissick.
I want to go back to your statement just now about the regional schools. The bill is pretty nebulous on that point, isn't it?
It is. My concern is because the three largest schools in the state of Oregon are going to have institutional boards, will that overshadow regional schools in an aspect of governing, and how will we have equal representation with OUS or potentially another department of post-secondary education?
Would you and your colleagues, obviously, do you think they would feel better about the bill if there was a more solid plan for the four other schools?
Yes, I think we would. If there was language in there that specifically outlined how it would affect regional schools, we'd be more inclined to give the bill a second look.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes. Oh, go ahead. Well, it certainly would allay some of our concerns. It certainly not does not cover the whole of Portland State University's concerns.
Sure,
right.
Sure. No, no, no.
From
of course.
Eastern perspective for clarification.
Very good. Thank okay. you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're creating interstate rivalry here.
Right?
So no.
Well,
You know, and let me clarify that, you know, the amendments that you'll see, you know, coming from us to 2149 or to the other bill, the 3120, will clarify some of those questions that you're raising, Evan. And, you know, we got a presentation last week of, you know, some of the current thinking about where the other universities would land. You know, essentially, you know, at this time we're thinking about three boards for the three research universities, and then a single board for the four teaching universities. Now, is that where we're finally going to land? We don't know. But through their consortium board, the four teaching universities would have equal status to the other boards, and that is the goal here. Evan, in terms of you had a concern that, oh yeah, the tuition setting, which is something that we wanted to, you know, to really focus on today. So the way the recommendation from the Joint Committee is that individual institutions, whether it's the board for Portland State, Oregon State, or University of Oregon, or the consortium board for the others, would have authority to raise tuition for in-state students up to 5%. And then outside of that, it would have to look, you know, I think our thinking is to the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission for authority to raise it higher, and ultimately the legislature. Is that kind of what you were thinking in terms of who decides beyond the 5%?
So, when I looked at the bill, it seemed like it was the HEC, then the OAIB, and then the state legislature, as it was kind of layers. Is that a correct vision? Or at the very least, it seems that you could clarify the process a bit. From my experience, I would much rather move. That is relatively clear, and it maintains a similarity to what we do now, except that the HEC is essentially replacing the OUS in our current scheme.
I
do still have concerns about the 5%. Going at 5% a year is still a considerable rate of increase, and I think it would be perhaps prudent to still allow the state legislature to do things like place caps lower when funding is higher.
I promise you, this legislature will never give up its ability to put budget notes onto the university budgets.
They're just notes.
They're notes that tend to be followed. Thank you. Other questions? Okay, thank you, both of you.
Thank you.
Okay, Catherine Eaton, please. And Lamar Wise. And Amelia Harris.
You know, while they're coming up, I'd just like to comment that bonding thing relates to tuition as well, in the extent to which a university gets indebted and has to pay debt service is going to affect the ability to control tuition. It's going to be one of the important factors.
I agree with that, sir. Ms. Eaton, welcome back.
Good morning. Chair Dembro,
and Ms. Eaton, you don't need to be right up against it. You can be farther back.
Okay.
Thank you.
For the record, my name is Catherine Eaton, and I reside in Eugene. Last year, I attended the majority of the meetings for the Special Committee on Higher Education, and I was able to hear the viewpoints from all seven presidents, from faculty members, from students, from staff, both union and non-members. And the recommendations and the findings that have emerged into House Bill 21 and 49 and Senate Bill 270 have generally been maintained in those bills. However, they're greatly amplified from the seven pages that we looked at in October. And today I'm going to generally address House Bill 49, recognizing that there are going to be amendments and changes. My perspective comes from several areas. As a retired University of Oregon faculty member and president of the University Faculty Senate, an alumni with two UO degrees, the mother of two UO graduates, one of whom was student body president, and the grandmother of two recent UO grads, and one still in college as a sophomore. I grew up in the Middle West at the University of Minnesota High School and in the four-year institution, which had and still has a Board of Regents. One of the many positive things about House Bill 2149 is a requirement for budget development by the institutional boards, but the legislative presentation for funding will be done by the Higher Education Reviewing Body. To this day, in Minnesota, the Board of Regents debates with the legislature every year over what their budget's going to be, and 2149 will take that out of the hands of individual boards, which is what I understand was one of the problems in the 1920s and 30s when each institution came to the legislature to battle for their own dollars. So that's all settled in this. Specifically, I have a few comments. I believe the wider mission of community colleges and universities is very sound, but that each of the institutions also has a separate mission revolving around its student body and its programs and services, and it should be allowed to move forward in those directions. I support the establishment of boards of directors for the University of Oregon at Portland State University and the addition of Oregon State University and the oversight provisions in 2149 for OIT and the regional universities. The mandates for cooperation and coordination across the higher education system are critical, and the annual review and reporting process has been outlined. Interaction of ideas and interchanges of programs and services must continue. As the boards of directors, 11 to 15 members, or beyond that, as proposed by PSU, gives the flexibility to the various types of viewpoints and talents for the individual institutions that they may desire. I do believe, however, that there should be a stipulation in legislation concerning students, faculty, and staff representation. The numbers may vary in the specific institutions, but their voices should be very much a part of the decision-making process. Tuition setting is a sticky wicket. There has been some balance. There has to be some balance between the needs of the institutions and the students and families who pay that tuition. Ideally, the state should be a larger factor in providing support for our higher education institutions, but I don't see that in the near future. Using the Portland Consumer Price Index as one of the markers makes sense, but the recommended 5% annual rise is troubling. And one in one section, the wording is 5% or more. And I really support the students' concern about exactly how that's going to be referred. The powers granted to the boards of directors regarding hiring, firing, borrowing, construction of facilities, ownership, bonding, and others cover the legal basis. The requirements for reporting to the Oregon Education Investment Board and the Higher Education Coordinating Commission are very clear, as well as the requirements for interinstitutional cooperation and coordination. I think those are two very important pieces. As I said, there will be amendments as it goes through the hearing and the discussion process and interfaces with the Senate version. It represents, I believe, an excellent approach and new direction for Oregon public higher education as we move to a seamless education system. And I thank you for this opportunity to comment.
Thank you very much, Ms. Eaton. I appreciate those comments. Any questions of Ms. Eaton at this time? Okay, thank you. Then, Mr. Wise.
Hi. Chin Dimbrough and the members of the committee. First off, I'd like to thank you for your commitment to public higher education. My name is Lamar Wise. I am a student at the University of Oregon. I'm a student senator that was actually elected on trying my best to make education as affordable and as accessible as possible. So that's the platform I ran off of, and that's why I'm here. With that being said, I write this testimony urging the state legislature to kill HB 2149. As a representative of the Oregon Student Association and a member of the Student Senate at the U of O, I've seen the need and importance for a robust statewide system. First off, I'm fearful of not having a tuition cap for both in-state and out-of-state students, and even if there is a 5% tuition cap suggested for in-state students, there are multiple ways for the institutional boards to be approved to go above that cap. I see numerous problems with this part of the bill. Students already are having a hard time as it is trying to afford college, and having no tuition cap has dangerous implications for continuing the trend of having skyrocketing tuition. The state needs to fight for its higher education, I believe, and it's time to prioritize it once again. I myself have had a hard time affording school. Last year, I couch surfed for multiple months and saw my bank account with no money in it. I often had to make the decision between buying food for the week or buying books for school. And frankly, students shouldn't have to make that decision at all. Even if tuition rose 5%, though it may seem insignificant, it equates to hundreds of dollars more that students would have to pay. And for students in situations like mine, that could mean the end for their higher education. This is to say, pulling away from the state does not solve the issue of providing a more accessible and affordable higher education. And in my opinion, that's exactly what we as a state should be focusing on. And it's time for the state legislature to have real conversations on what 40-40-20 is supposed to look like. And I don't believe moving towards a more business-like model is the right answer for Oregon's public higher education. I think as a state, we can do better. We need to have tuition setting power be with elected officials so that we as students can hold them accountable. We need to have a statewide coordinated system of education so that we can use resources the best way that we can. And we need to have a funding model that is advantageous for all students to attend Oregon public schools. I know the system that we currently have is not the best, don't get me wrong, but I believe having institutional boards sets the wrong tone for where we as Oregonians would like to be to obtain a quality, affordable education. And regardless of my position, some of the things that I see wrong with the bill or things that should be changed is one, I think we should prioritize the ratio of in-state students to out-of-state students. I do believe that we should continue to have the majority of in-state students be a part of the universities, just to continue to serve our mission as of being a public higher education institution. So that's one. The second thing is equal representation of student, staff, and faculty. And I know we've talked about this a little earlier today, and I just wanted to address that. Representative Dembro, you were talking about how this was a question amongst the committee. And to answer that question, I do think there should be representation, and I think it should be as equal as possible. And then lastly, I think we should have the most the most coordination as possible in terms of our programming or the programs we provide for each university and for each of the institutions to cut back on competition. I do not want to see our state model go towards a more competitive. I don't know, what's the word, atmosphere or nature or whatever. I want to stay away from that because we, regardless of what happens, should be prioritizing education and not pushing towards a more business-like model. Thank you for your consideration of my testimony. If you have any questions, please let me know. But thank you.
Thank you very much for that, Mr. Wise. And we will, I'm sure, have questions of you. But let's hear from Ms. Harris first.
Thank you, Chair Dembro and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Amelia Harris, and I am president of the Associate Students of Oregon State University, and I am also the vice chair of the Oregon Student Association. ASOSU and OSA believe that every Oregonian deserves access to an affordable and quality college education, and that students should be involved in the decisions that affect us. ASOSU is opposed to the bill HB 2149 in its current form. Student fee autonomy, cost of tuition to cover administrative costs, and committee representation are all concerns that ASOSU has regarding this bill. These institutional boards proposed by HB 2149 do not have enough sufficient student representation on them. Student voice and representation is key on these boards to ensure the boards are following the best interests of the university, including the student body. We appreciate that there is one student on the board with the new amendments in SB 270, but that is not enough. We need one undergraduate student, one graduate student, and two faculty members, as well as one classified staff member on the boards. These are absolutely key stakeholder groups that need to participate in the running of these universities. Students, faculty, and staff all have unique perspectives that need to be institutionalized on the board, and without them, the board will be out of touch regarding the needs of the university community. Institutional boards also face little accountability to the state in keeping tuition and administrative costs low. The 5% tuition increase cap is not low enough to keep tuition increases affordable for all students. Administrative costs at other universities have skyrocketed as a result of implementing institutional boards, and ASOSU is very concerned this pattern will continue in Oregon if institutional boards are implemented at some of Oregon's universities. This bill also removes the autonomy that students currently have over the student fees process. At OSU, the Student Incidental Fees Committee, a committee made up of students elected by the student body, has autonomy over student fees, and this bill would eliminate the process and leave the student body without control over how our own student fees are decided. ASOSU has many concerns about institutional boards like committee representation and the cost to students through its implementation, and we do not support the passage of HB 2149 in its current form. And thank you so much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you very much, Amelia. Questions? Yes, Rep. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate students, your comments and stuff. In your discussions with your group, as we talk about tuition, where it is, where it's come from, and where we are fearful that it could go, how much attention do you all pay to the cost drivers of your education? What actually contributes to those tuition increases?
Would you want me to respond or more?
Either or.
Okay. We're aware of the cost increases to tuition. I understand that PERS and PEB are huge cost drivers. However, the tuition is skyrocketing at these universities, and there are students on my campus as well as at U of O and never other university who are homeless because they can't afford tuition. And so, yes, there are cost drivers, and we also understand that it's incredibly challenging paying for tuition. Is there anything you would like to add?
Yeah, I I think I understand and know that each university and each college has a current service level that they have to reach just to keep the lights on and keep things moving. However, I do think that there's a difference between focusing on that current service level and prioritizing higher education and putting more resources towards that. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, I just wondered if in your deliberations the topic comes up. You know, we saw a report on Wednesday that actually says that about $1,900 per year for your tuition on average at the universities goes to benefits for employees. Just wondering if that's a concern as you see that amount growing. Would you say, you know, state of Oregon, institutions, whoever, maybe we ought to try to look at doing some things to kind of hold down that, because it is skyrocketing. It's going like that. Just wondering if that's ever been on your agenda to discuss at your meetings or not.
Well, I'll jump in, as I'm wont to do when Representative Johnson brings up this issue. You know, we did hear from Vice Chancellor Kent the other day a couple of facts. First, that, you know, what is driving up tuition is the disinvestment by the state, you know, in the state support fund for the universities. There's a direct relationship there. And second, that Oregon's faculty, university faculty, are underpaid relative to the national average. If you include their salary plus their benefits, their total compensation, they're not at the national average. So I would argue the reason they're not at the national average is because they don't have the revenues to be able to bring them to the national average. And that's a function of the disinvestment the state has made in its university system.
Sure.
Rep. Parker first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks to all three of you. Really enjoyed the presentations and your arguments. So we are somewhere between voting to approve the bill or voting to reject the bill, and we have a lot of room for movement in there, and I think you've all made really good points for where we go. You raised a point. You told me something I didn't know about the committee, I think you said, at OSU, made up of students approving fees. So how have your fees changed comparable to other state institutions? Have you been able to hold those fees down compared to other schools?
You're asking about the Student Fees Committee, I believe?
Yes.
Yes. So I can't give you specifics, but we try very hard to keep the cost to the student fee funded services low. And
we try very hard to keep
right,
enough money going
that.
To your schools, and
yes.
We fail.
And I can't give an exact example, but with the Memorial Union on campus, the amount of money that they get in comparison to the number of students they serve is significantly lower than other Memorial Unions across the nation. And I can't give you exact numbers, but I do know that also the Memorial Union is set up to serve around 10,000 students, and we did get approval for the new Student Experience Center, and so that's wonderful, but we have been operating in a very small space, limited in the amount of people that we can have in our different programs, and as of this year, we will be decreasing our student fee for next year just because we have found ways to cut.
Okay, thanks.
Let me just follow up on the subject of dedicated fees, and then I'll turn it to you, Rep. Greenlich. That you know, we had a work group meeting yesterday. Rep. Johnson and I were part of bicameral, just talking about the general issues here. And one thing that we all agreed on was that we want to make sure that the bill maintains the current practice as far as student control of the dedicated fees. And so, you know, the lawyers are wrestling with the language on how to make sure that happens. But, you know, we hear your message loud and clear. Rep. Greenlich.
Yeah, I have a simple question. You both say you oppose the bill, and then you say there need to be some changes. Will you oppose the bill if the changes are made? I mean, are you opposed to the question of individual boards for the universities, or are you raising the issue of who's on the board and X, and how tuition, that sort of stuff?
Great question. Personally, I'm going to oppose it. even if the changes are made. I think the notion or the idea of having institutional boards is not the right mindset that we should be in, or framework that we should be working out of, just at a fundamental philosophical level.
And I think that if there are changes made to the bill, it could be more appealing, but fundamentally, we are opposed to institutional boards. But I think that there are ways that we could make it effective and work for everybody if there are these changes that are made.
Thank you. The reason that I raise that is the basic principles we have is that the university communities need to be support where we're going, and I don't see much evidence of support from at least this one piece of the university community, so I'm not sure how we gauge that question.
It is a challenge for us. I will say, though, that addressing the question of whether students are better served by a local university board or a statewide board, you know, as we currently have, in my own experience, I live in a world, a community college world, where we have local boards, and it's been my experience that having a board that is close to home, as it were, you know, that's close to the students geographically as well as where their focus is, allows students and faculty to advocate better for their needs. I mean, it's just easier to get people to go and address the board and express their, you know, their concerns about particular issues. And if you, you know, an interesting fact is if you were, I'm at Portland Community College, and you know, we have Portland Community College, we have Portland State Universities. If you were to look at the percentage increase in tuition at PCC as opposed to PSU over the last 10 years, they're within about a tenth of a percent increase difference. And so, you know, even though PCC has a local board, PSU has, you know, is under the State Board of Higher Ed, I think there are other dynamics really that are driving the, you know, the increases of tuition. But I do think that it is really, it's convenient for students. If I think of the number of times that, well, I guess I could ask you, Mr. Wise, I mean, how often do you go to the meetings of the State Board of Higher Ed?
I send testimony and go when there are issues that I care about that are being discussed. I would like to say, though, that there's also a difference between local boards and institutional boards. Local boards, it is very close to home. They are often elected officials people from the university, and students or faculty or whatever have say over that. As the bill currently is right now, it is an institutional board, there are outside influences that can come upon that board, and that's my concern.
Thank you. Rep. Gorsuch, then Rep. Gilliam.
Good. Guess Rep. I Gilliam. Wanted to get in before Rep. Gilliam.
Very wise.
I just wanted to say, well, this is kind of like you. I just wanted to say you must be very serious about this because we have a duck and a beaver both arguing on the same side. I think that's very impressive. No civil war here. Thank you.
That's it.
That's all I have for it. That's all I got.
Rep. Gilliam, top that, please.
That was mine. No. Thank you all for being here, and you are number three and four of some very impressive student presentations, mm-hmm. and so I appreciate it very much. I hesitate to try to match wits with you. You've studied this pretty carefully. But I'd like to say we weren't surprised at your discussion regarding tuition. I think that's a legitimate and predictable point of view from students. I don't know about skyrocketing, but I do know how challenging it must be. Particularly for you, and anybody can answer, but for you, Mr. Wise, it's Wise, correct?
Correct.
If you were president of your university.
Like university president or student body?
Of the entire university, okay. Which actually I think is possible. Say more about
the priorities that prevent the kind of spending of the university budget that this maybe would help tuition. You alluded to it, and I just wondered, from your perspective, if you were in charge, how would you reprioritize the spending?
Well, I mean, that's a good question. I have a couple of thoughts on that. One, as of right now, I'm a student, and of course, I have a different perspective on things. But if I were to be in that position, my position on things might be different. But with that being said, I think no matter what position I'm in, no matter where I am, I will still advocate for more affordable, a more affordable, more cost-effective way to get students inside of the school. And no matter what happens, I think that's what we should be doing. If I was the university president, I'd be fighting as hard as I could for the state to be reinvesting. That's what I'd be doing. I wouldn't look at cuts. I would be organizing, and I would be talking to my students and telling them, hey, this is our situation. And what we should do is not fight amongst each other, but go to the state and tell them how important our education is to us and how it should be prioritized.
Thank you. Thank you, all three of you. Great. Okay, I'm going to call up our last panel. Tim Thompson, Bob Liebman, and Rob Fulmer. Whoever wants to go first, go first. We'll have questions for all of you, I'm sure.
Chair Dembro, members of the committee, Tim Thompson.
Tim, could you put the microphone? Yes, thanks. Yeah. But you don't have to be right up against it.
All right. I'm Tim Thompson. I'm a professor of mathematics at Oregon Institute of Technology. I'm here on behalf of the Association of Oregon Faculties, which is a independent, nonprofit, non-union organized group of faculty around the state. I don't know that I can elaborate much on the board issue. I think in the future this committee may need a much bigger room by the time you get the HEC and the OEIB and all these individual boards in here. I think you may need more room. I believe that the faculty are one of the drivers of the missions of universities, and in so they would, I believe that they do need a seat along with staff and students on any individual boards. It is the faculty and students who who bring the missions to light of the institutions. That's really where it happens. There are accreditation issues that come up that perhaps board members may not realize how important those things are, and faculty bring those to the boards. I think there's some legitimacy that could be brought to boards by simply having students and faculty on there. There's a sense of when you're included in something, we all seem to work better. And I don't think that's just true in university settings. I think that's true everywhere. So I appreciate all the work that everyone has done. It's a big task. I mean, you are rewriting the Oregon University system. I mean, that is what's happening, right? And I have seen faculty, particularly at my own school, go from the whole thought of perhaps independent boards being completely ridiculous to the fact that we may have to accept this, and this may be the future. And so I'm here to just try to make sure that faculty, staff, and students, right, that it's important that we have a say, and that you would really take that into consideration. There are a lot of issues that occur on the campuses that boards may not know, but if we could get those in the bill, that'd be great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm told that I have to stay within 3 minutes, which is about enough time for an egg, but very unlikely for a professor to speak. So I'll try to be mindful of that time and move ahead. I'm grateful to Chairman Dembrough, Vice Chair Huffman, Vice Chair Harker for the chance to speak on behalf of HB 2149, which authorizes the creation of an institutional board for PSU. And I'll limit my remarks to the composition of that board. I'm a professor of sociology and urban studies, but I'm speaking to you as a faculty.
Can you identify yourself for the record?
Sure. My name is Bob Liebman. I'm a professor of sociology and urban studies, and I'm speaking today as a PSU faculty senator and as one of the members of the Senate Steering Committee. The PSU Faculty Senate was fully on board HB 2149. The Senate charged a task force with a review of the proposed institutional board based on the operation of comparable boards at public universities. It found that the institutional board would enable PSU to move more effectively toward its key goals, to increase access, to improve student success, to enhance research and teaching, all in keeping with our motto, "Let knowledge serve the city." Based on that report, this Faculty Senate passed a resolution of support for the creation of institutional boards and for continued faculty participation. That resolution and report are appended to my statement. Let me just finish a few remarks ahead of it. I'm here on behalf of many senators who supported the resolution to express our concerns for the effects of the proposed amendment to SB 270, denoted as SB 271. In which Section 5.4 adds language excluding faculty from participation. Except for the president of the university and a student member of the governing board, no member of the board may be an employee of the university. And I want here quickly to make 3 points within that 3 minutes. The first is continuity. If passed, these amendments to SB 270 will break a long and successful tradition of faculty participation on the Oregon State Board of Higher Ed, as you've heard. To my knowledge, faculty representatives have been important partners in good governance through their direct knowledge of teaching and learning conditions, research and public service. Most come from home campuses where they have long experience. Some served as members of the Interinstitutional Faculty Senate where they have a broad view of what's going on at the partner campuses. Very often these representatives acted as mentors when new people enter the board who have not before been at Oregon universities. They're teachers and mentors. My second concern is comparability. If passed, the amendments would separate Oregon from states like California, where the chair and the vice chair of the University of California Academic Council, its faculty senate, sit on the Board of Regents. By decision of the Academic Council, these faculty representatives do not vote, unlike Oregon, but they're included in all discussions and all debates, all regents-only sessions. They're fully members. In fact, all of the working groups in California include advisory members, these two folks, for the Board of Regents to have additional input. My third concern is synergy. One of the compelling reasons for the creation of institutional boards is the realization that now and even more in the future, public universities must earn their resources and reputations by building the capacity of the regions they serve. Many Oregon faculty are in the forefront of these efforts, including, for example, University of Oregon Professor John Canna, a medicinal chemist who holds 73 patents, including one which launched the new firm Cascade Prodrug for enhanced cancer therapy, or my colleague at PSU, David Payton, whose work on anti-malarial drugs led to the launch of the firm Design Medics. In the race for innovation, public universities are incubators of the startups that will grow Oregon employment and improve the quality of life, much as Tektronix in Mark Hass's district was in an earlier generation. And add to that the search for new ways to improve the public good, where universities are vital partners, as is happening now in the Cradle to Career Project, which partners the Portland Public Schools and the Portland State Graduate School of Education to keep students on track and on target to finish the degree. Institutional boards will likely be meeting places between willing actors and promising ideas, between such problems and solutions to which the engagement of research, teaching, and service can offer solutions. As the University of California recognized in composing its Board of Regents, faculty participation is a route for the two-way communication between public representatives and academic professionals, in which both parties have working knowledge to keep state higher education responsive to its students, citizens, and the economy. Add to that my own alma mater, the State University of New York, the largest system in the United States, which has faculty representatives. The introduction to HB 2149 recognizes the importance of that relationship by prescribing institutional boards that are similar to the State Board of Higher Ed in composition, constitution, transparency. And it's not just state boards. The list of schools that include faculty representatives are Cornell, Duke, Carnegie Mellon, a national leader in technology innovation, Howard University, historically black college in Washington. Many other schools, Cal State, for example, have faculty representatives as well. So on behalf of faculty at Portland State, I call on you as members of the special committee to maintain the character of HB 2149 by rejecting any proposed amendment to either SB 270 or HB 2149, which would bring an end to a long and fruitful tradition of faculty participation. Faculty have knowledge and time and the will to help. Thank you for your opportunity to testify. I'm happy to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Bob. Rob, let's hear from you first.
Sure. Good morning. My name is Rob Fulmer, and I'm a member of the Service Employees International Union, Local 503. SEIU represents about 4,000 classified workers who support students and faculty in the Oregon University system. We work in food, custodial services, facilities and grounds maintenance, financial and academic offices, IT and campus libraries. I am a steward and PSU's bargaining delegate, and I am representing our chapter in the ongoing financial restructuring at PSU. Professionally, I work as one of two IT staff in the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, serving the IT support and planning needs of over 600 faculty and staff in the college, a capacity in which I've served since 2005. I support Mr. Liebman here. Professor Liebman is one of my customers, as is David Payton, who he mentioned in his talk. I've spent my career in higher education because I believe in the mission of preparing our youth to be able to make contributions to our society as a fundamental responsibility. I really believe that. I'm here today to offer testimony on HB 2149 pertaining to the establishment of institutional boards for public universities. While classified workers are pleased that a single bargaining unit is maintained in the bill, we have continued concerns about the bills that have been brought forward to the state. We remain skeptical of the merit of the formation of boards to the state overall, but have comments to make this bill better. We see three issues with the bill, which I will speak to here today. First is the composition of the board, which may end up shutting out the campus community. The second is unfettered tuition setting for students other than resident undergraduates at the institutional level. And the third is ambiguity about the role and scope of shared services that makes it difficult to accurately predict how much boards will cost. SEIU strongly believes that the effort to craft an institutional governance pathway in HB 2149 must include internal staff on these boards. This summer, the Joint Committee on Governance worked with LC 759 that listed two faculties, two students, and one staff classified in its language, and we believe that this should be the makeup with an 11 to 15 person board. To keep these selections representative, it is critical that that internal groups choose these board members with confirmation by the governor's office and or Senate. Okay, so this next section, it talks to something that actually came up in conversation. It was raised by you, Representative Greenlake. There is a narrative that you may have heard about. Actually, I think it was Representative Johnson. I take it back. There is a narrative that you may have heard about internal representation that we believe is inaccurate. That is that internal representatives, because of their position as either payers of tuition or collectors of salary, are sure to be narrowly focused on these issues and therefore a poor choice to serve on institutional boards. That discussion has been had in this room, and I want to speak to it. The fact is, everyone who serves on a board, whether it's a business leader, alumni, a philanthropist, brings an array of self-interest to the table. Everyone does. I mean, it's natural. And Just as a realtor or a banker on the board would not participate in discussions about purchasing property that could benefit their private interest, internal constituents would demur on issues directly related to their own financial self-interests. I think that's a reasonable accommodation that could be made for any type of board member. So it's not like we're talking about something that can't be dealt with reasonably. And I would remind you that there was opposition to internal representation of the State Board of Higher Education, too. Turns out, even though that hasn't worked everywhere, over time, it has proven to work in Oregon. And it will work on institutional boards. The second issue that this bill does nothing to that I wanted to address was that this bill does nothing to curtail tuition spikes for any group other than resident undergraduates. Specifically, we are worried about the implications for resident graduate students and strongly urge that in-state graduate tuition be capped. If you leave this in the hands of the boards, there are no protections there. The third concern we have with the bill is how little it speaks to the scope of shared services between public universities with institutional boards and those that remain in OUS. You may be aware of the presentation made by the Governance and Policy Committee of the State Board of Higher Education on March 16th of last year that estimated the service costs that each of these boards could incur as somewhere between $3.1 and $8 million per board per year. Now, we recognize that not everyone found these figures credible, but we have yet to hear anything different from the protesting institutions. Without having a better understanding of how shared services will work, the real cost of independence that this bill would establish is elusive. This leads me to the first of our two global concerns about institutional boards this bill would create. At a time when public higher education in Oregon has been feeling increasing financial pressure while inflation and adjusted state funding has steadily declined, they come at a price, and their overall benefit is uncertain. We know the autonomy they seek and they would provide is highly valued by the power brokers at the universities that seek them, but whether the interests of students and taxpayers will be well served by them is unclear. As a general rule, we see efficiencies resulting from consolidated services and coordinated programming among peer institutions. Institutional boards move the state's public universities in the opposite direction. Finally, there's history available to remind us about what happens when Oregon universities come individually to ask for resources. The State Board of Higher Education and the Oregon University System were formed for good reasons, and if this legislation passes, there are good reasons to believe, based on that history, that Oregonians who attend the smaller regional universities will end up losing out. The interim president of Western Oregon University testified in May 2012 to the Special Committee on University Governments. I have attached his entire testimony as an additional document for your review. And I will leave you with his words on the topic of competing universities. He said, and I quote, "I ask, are we better separating and becoming seven universities, seven competitors? This might be good in the corporate world, pitting one against the other in the competition to survive, to maximize profits, and even promote innovation. However, it also creates winners and losers. Oregon and Oregonians cannot afford losing institutions of higher education supporting the 40-40-20 goal, and competing universities does a disservice to its citizenry." Thank you for your time today. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rob. Actually, before I call on you members, colleagues, I want you to know that Rob raised the issue of shared services, and we will be devoting one of our Fridays to that issue. Former Chancellor Pernsteiner has been charged with working with the presidents to talk about how shared services, the integrity of shared services, can be maintained, and just how that might work in an environment in which we had local boards. So we'll, I think that, as you read the preamble to House Bill 2149, that was a concern of ours. We did see that there are benefits to having economies of scale. So to see how we can maintain shared services while providing flexibility for the institutions. And the other issue I would just mention is Rob talked about the issue of unfettered control over non-resident fees, that would be left up to graduate fees. And that was, there we just maintained current practice. Right now the individual university presidents have discretion over the setting of their graduate fees and their non-resident fees. What this would do is it would set that authority, instead of being in the hands of the individual president, it would be in the hands of the individual university board. Rep. Gallegos, and then Rep. Greenlick.
Thank you, Chair Dembro. Panelists, I want to thank you for your testimony, students, faculty. My previous comment, notwithstanding, about the faculty conflict of interest and so on, I know as a faculty member nothing drove me more crazy than having these mindless and irrational decisions coming down from administration. But I think I just believe that a good policy comes from giving people voice and from participation of people who have interests in the decisions made by whatever body. And I want to make clear that I wasn't speaking against faculty participation, because I really believe it is necessary. So again, sort of to the framers of the bill, I was thinking that as we have skyrocketing tuitions, I anticipate that students are turning more and more to parents and grandparents to support their tuition expenses. And so perhaps we should have parents and grandparents on this board as well. Just a thought.
Thank you, Rep. Rep. Greenlick.
Guess what? Governor Romney suggested.
Oh yeah.
I'm trying to assess the issue of the support of the university community to this whole thing, and I think what I hear, although all of you have issues about who's on the board, that the faculties generally support an institutional board, but that SEIU generally would prefer not to deal with institutional boards. Am I reading those two things right?
I think that's accurate. Our position is that if we must have boards, let's at least make them the least bad.
There's a motto.
Sounds like my student career.
I would say...
Tim, could you go to the microphone?
I guess I would add that, as I said, I think we went through an evolution. Faculty, at least at our school, and I know at a few other schools, of this has got to be the worst idea anyone has ever come up with. Two, this looks like it's going to happen. How can we be a player in it? And how can we make sure that it works for the state of Oregon? In the end, it's about the students, right? I mean, it's all about the students. That's what we do. We educate students. And so I can't say that we're opposed. I had to check a little box on that form, right? But I said opposed, but, well, unless amended.
Yes, Bob.
I think that people are on board for the fact that there's such a porous boundary between the campus and the community. And when we talk about stakeholders, we're talking about people who are using the university as a library, as a lecture hall for classes. I mean, and for that reason, the hope is to build a bigger constituency of support among donors, voters, users, and having people who are close by, in the same way that Representative Dembro spoke of the custom and community college boards, you'd have a real constituency of the people who are prime users. It's not just, in our case, a major football team. It's a kind of everyday transit point that and it's no joke that the most used stop in the whole of the TriMet system is PSU, and we want to represent all those people as best we can in their multiple roles in the university.
Thanks. Rip Gorsuch.
Couple of things. To go back to OIT, I've heard some people recently around the building talking about possible differences between OIT and the other three regionals, EOU, WOU, and SOU, especially because of its high-tech sort of orientation and its different needs for equipment. And some folks have proposed to me that it might not be a good idea to lump OIT with the other three. Now, I haven't talked to the other three about how they feel about boards, but would you say that's something to at least consider in terms of OIT perhaps being in its own board?
anything that I would probably say would be just personal now.
Okay. Correct? Well, that's fine. In your personal opinion.
I don't know. I do know that our programs are very expensive. I mean, you know, it costs money to put medical imaging machines and MRIs and CAT scans in buildings, right? It's expensive. We're not Portland State. We're not OHSU. I don't know. I look at the cost of it, and my concern would be, what's it going to cost? I mean, we're on a shoestring budget now.
Right.
And so what's the cost of a board going to be to school, any regional school? I mean, that's a problem, I think. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The other thing, too, is, and this is just more of a comment, kind of tying in with some of the others. The one thing that people need to remember is that education has changed. And I'm not talking about structure now, but I'm talking about its approach. And the old approach was top-down. Today, many of us, community college and higher ed, talk about shared governance and collegial relationships between board members and staff and faculty and students. And so I think that model is what we're trying to bring to the classroom. I think it fits in very well with the governance that we're working towards as well. I don't think it's a surprise that we're working towards a situation where there are many people who think that sort of shared governance and it makes sense based on the changes in educational culture. Anyway, just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You know, we heard a comment the other day from Vice Chancellor Kenton about how American universities are magnets for students from all over the world because of the excellent work that they do. You know, I would argue that, you know, part of the reason for that is the strong tradition of academic freedom and shared governance that higher ed has always had. And, you know, I think it is a really, it's a profound sort of value.
So it's that log, right, with the professor on one end and the student on the other.
There you go. Okay, gentlemen, thank you very much for your testimony. And thanks to everyone who came forth. I'm not sure yet which topics we'll be focusing on next week, but probably by the end of the day we'll have to figure that out, and we'll let you know. Stay tuned. This is an ongoing conversation, and we look forward to your input and your participation. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2149, and colleagues, we are adjourned.